This is the Play to Win podcast from Aconite Books with me, James Wallace. This first series of the podcast accompanies my new book, Everybody Wins, Four Decades of the Greatest Board Games Ever Made, out now in the UK and coming to the US and Canada in spring 2023. In the first episode, we tackled the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s, the first few years of the Spiel des Jahres German Game of the Year competition, but also the first inklings of the rise of what would become the flood of modern board games, the renaissance in game design that would lead us to where we are today. In this episode, we're looking at the 1980s to the 1990s, a tumultuous time, and the rise of what we would consider Eurogame design, what becomes the defining features of German game design. However, we're not looking at the games themselves. That's what the book does. This one is much more about games culture at the time. What was going on in the world of games? Who the movers and shakers were? How people regarded games? How people found games? And what the games themselves were like? What we enjoyed about them? And how we were regarded by the outside world for doing that. I'm joined by two stalwarts of the British games industry scene, Mark Gascoigne and Jervis Johnson. We were hoping to record them together, but sadly illness didn't permit that. So I spoke to Jervis first of all about his time and his huge career at Games Workshop, where he designed most notably Blood Bowl, but also Adeptus Titanicus, was the co-designer on Necromunda, and more recently co-creator of Warhammer Age of Sigmar. And this is a time at which Games Workshop went from being a scrappy independent distributor of specialist board games and war games, mostly imported from America and some reprinted from America, to a company floated on the stock market valued at around £50 million, which felt like a lot back then. I'm delighted to be joined by Jervis Johnson, a key figure, I think, in the development of modern British games, the creator of Blood Bowl, among others, but also someone who's been involved with games even longer than he's been with Games Workshop. This is an interesting time. This is an interesting 10 years we're talking about in the development of German games. What was your awareness of it at the time?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I have to say that at the time, I was not terribly aware of what was going on. I knew a bit about the Spiel des Jahres. You know, you couldn't be involved in the games business and not. But for me, this period was one where I started designing games for Games Workshop. Pretty much on the nose of the yes. From 1986. I was working on Blood Bowl. And then various other games. Games Workshop was still producing board games at that time, so we were making games too. And so my focus was very much on the British and the American board game scene and working in with designers in the UK who were interested in doing board games. They'd write in to us and say, I've got an idea for a game, or we'd get in touch with people. And sometimes we'd be commissioned, so I'd be told we want a game on this subject, and I'd go off and design it. But other games, like Chainsaw Warrior, various other games, Blood Royale and stuff like that, were submitted to us.
Mm. And Fury of Dracula.
Fury of Dracula.
As well, which was, I think, came out 86 or 87. But it must be said, owes a considerable debt to
Scotland Yard.
Scotland Yard, which won the Spiel in 82 or 83.
Yeah.
But that came in from a freelancer.
That's right. That's Steve Hand, who also designed Chainsaw Warrior, and then came to work in the studio. But he'd got the idea for Fury of Dracula already, and so it was completely his own design. In so much as it was inspired by. But then I think that takes you onto a subject of. There. In many ways, there are no new rule mechanics. I mean, you get some ideas where things are put together in a different way, but lots of games influence lots of other games.
Yes, absolutely. Whether it's thematically or through rules mechanics, and
I mean, there's no question. Fury of Dracula is a beautiful tie of theme to mechanics. The idea of chasing Dracula across Europe almost works better than chasing Mr. X across central London, because Dracula can go anywhere and, of course, can vanish. And then there's the extra powers that Fury of Dracula adds in and the extra excitement. It's a much longer game, a much more tactically involved game.
It is. And I think there's an interesting thing there, because in many ways now, I look at Scotland Yard and I say it's purer. The design in it is more Fury of Dracula is... Steve wanted it to be thematic. He loved the Dracula books, and he wanted to get as much of those elements in as he could. And that obviously what that does is it makes the game more detailed and complicated in the way that the combat works and the way that the events and things within the game work. Whereas Scotland Yard is much more that kind of Euro game thing of there's an interesting set of mechanics with a theme put on top. That just to kind of give you something to kind of get your teeth into and get a handle on, really.
To answer the question, why am I doing this?
Yeah, exactly. So I think that and that means that the playing them is quite, the experience is actually quite different. And there are going to be, you're going to prefer one or the other, probably.
Definitely.
Depending on where your interests and what you're looking for from a game, where those things lie.
Yes. So, yeah, you were saying I don't think you're alone in the games community in not being entirely aware of what was going on with the German scene at this particular time. I was based in London at the time, and apart from one or two shops, there were very, very few shops selling imported German or European games at the time. And there were many more, particularly the nascent Games Workshop Empire, selling American games. So that was certainly where my influences at the time were coming from, things like Battletech and... I'm trying to think of what else. And the big MB boxes like Shogun and Axis and Allies. There was a lot of that, what subsequently rather unfairly became known as Ameritrash.
Yeah, I think it is a little bit unfair because there's some great stuff being done there. And I mean, also you've got the little mini games. That was one of the things I remember quite often, like Car Wars, Ogre. Ogre is a great little game, I think. Again, it's basically, it's a very simple idea.
The one
gigantic tank. In case people haven't ever played it, it's a war game. So kind of like with its roots in the Avalon Hill and SPI hex and counter war games. So you have hexagons and cardboard counters. And on one side, you have a gigantic tank.
Yeah.
And on the other side, you have lots of little infantry squads and things. You basically have to try and whittle it down and destroy it before it gets across the map to the other side, where it's going to blow something up of vital strategic importance.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful little game. And it came in a little tiny box, basically. It was small.
Yes, it was originally. It was Microgames did it originally in a cardboard box. And then Steve Jackson Games took it over and I think did it in a Ziploc bag.
Yeah.
And then... they did little plastic boxes. And that, more recently, they've kickstarted it. And it's as big as those big MB boxes I mentioned a while ago.
I can remember there were some other games again. It might be slightly before this period that we're talking about specifically. There was Barbarian Prince, which was a solo game. And
Heritage, I think, was the company.
Yes, that's right. And one of the things... Yes. But the thing I can remember about Barbarian Prince was that at that time I was working for Games Workshop and I was in trade sales. So I phoned up toy shops and say, you really should be stocking our games and things. And Barbarian Prince, we couldn't keep it in stock. It just sold out constantly. It was one of our most popular titles.
Well, I mean, one of the other things that doesn't feature at all in their Spieletiers lists, but was really big in the late 80s and early 90s, was tabletop role-playing games.
Yeah.
And Games Workshop, by this point, having had the exclusive license for Dungeons & Dragons, had lost it. And I think it was being, in the UK at least, distributed by TSR UK.
Yeah.
But were you selling role-playing games?
We sold. I mean, at that time, really, Games Workshop was an importer and distributor. So we primarily of American games. We did get some. Do you remember the Italian games?
No.
I'm not going to be able to remember the names of it now. Alessio Cavatori is going to kill me because he loves those games. He grew up playing them. But there was an Italian company that made beautifully produced war games in very big boxes. So games from around the world, really, we'd bring them into the Games Workshop, bring them into the country, and then distribute them on. And that included really all of the role-playing games. So we did sell Dungeons & Dragons. We bought it from TSR UK, and then because we had contact with lots of games shops, and there were Games Workshop stores. Yes. Of course, at the time. But also all of the other ones, Champions. My mind's going blank now, of course, but there were so many role-playing games around at the time.
I think from 86 onwards, I mean, 89 you had, I think Shadowrun was 89.
Yes.
Vampire was 1991. Yes, I mean, some of the big hitters and things that have gone on to be Major League computer games, and even Vampire was briefly a TV series. And it's influenced that, interesting, that doesn't seem to have, it has influenced the German scene at the time, because in fact Enchanted Forest is noted for being the first with a fantasy theme, even though it's a fairy tale theme rather than fantasy. Mm-hmm. But it was D&D that really pushed that whole idea of heroic fantasy as a setting for games.
There were
one or two before.
Yes. And the other big thing that came out in that period is Magic the Gathering, of course.
Yes, 1993.
Yeah.
Certainly financially changed the whole landscape of gaming. Mm-hmm. The figure that springs to mind is they sold 10 million cards in their first 2 months and went on to just, you know, blow down doors. It was a collecting gold rush, and on the back of that, huge numbers of other publishers just leapt onto it and produced it. Certainly the first wave of follow-up CCGs were mostly rubbish. Not entirely, but I have one called Jan Can Po, which is, it's literally the card game of rock, scissors, paper. There are three warring tribes in the far future, the rock tribe, the scissors tribe, and the paper tribe. And that's all the stats you get on the card. and awful artwork. But that created a huge influx of new money into the industry, which, apart from anything else, allowed some of the American companies and companies around the world to take a risk on bringing more diverse games, particularly in the case we're talking about, German games, into the country in translation and seeing if there's a market for them.
Yeah. I think that it's that crossover, isn't it? Because Magic has been very influential on games in general, really. I mean, so many of them now have an element of card drafting, or the importance of cards within the game has become much more of a thing. But it's a two-way street. So you can look at the games on the list of the winners of that period, and you can see how they've carried on influencing things to this day. And outside their area, so Catan. Before it, there are games that use hex tiles. Later on, Games Workshop went on to do a campaign system with plastic hex tiles that you put together to create a map. You could fight battles.
Not Mighty Empires.
The later version of it. Actually, within this period, I would imagine the original Mighty Empires came out, which had cardboard tiles. Hex tiles.
Yes.
And there was Kings and Things.
Kings, I had completely forgotten game, Kings and Things. Tom Wham. Yes, originally Brilliant West End Games designer. In the States, and then republished by Games Workshop.
No. I mean, one of my favourite games is Awful Green Things from Outer Space.
I love
that game. I'm not going to be able to remember exactly when it came. I love that. I can remember talking about friends with it, and we decided that if we were ever going to form a rock band, then Awful Green Things was going to have to be the name, basically, because it's such a brilliant title. But Kings and Things, great game, uses hex tiles as well. So you've got hex and counter American wargaming kind of like things. And you can see sometimes as a games designer where you can say, I can see what they were playing with, and saying, I don't like this game very much, but actually these pieces I could do something quite good with.
That is the essence of game design, taking an existing game apart and seeing which bits you can reuse, or adding them to your mental toolkit so that when you're working on another problem, oh, this bit from such and such a game would fit in here if I tweak it a bit.
Absolutely. There's a quote which I think it's attributed to Picasso, and it's not. I'm not going to be able to remember what it was. But artists steal and amateurs merely copy. Mm-hmm. And I never quite understood it until there was a period. I would guess for me it would be like third edition Blood Bowl 1993 was when it mm-hmm. came out, when I changed from being an amateur games designer to being a professional one, even though I've been designing games for a while.
I love the fact you say the first two editions of Blood Bowl, hugely successful, hugely influential, were designed on an amateur basis.
Well, I think but within terms of that quote, they were, because what was happening was that with those games, I was taking ideas and mechanics, and it's almost like when you say that you were saying earlier about themes being plastered on top of an abstract game. I was taking a set of mechanics and saying, well, this might work. Yeah. So the first edition Blood Bowl, actually, it took the Warhammer rules from that period and just put them onto a board with a grid and two people running and then saying, and it's like American football, basically. Yeah. So you're running up and down trying to score goals. With third edition Blood Bowl, something changed, and what I was doing was I knew what my goals were, what I wanted the game's design to be like, there were ideas that I could borrow from other places, but I was using them for my own purposes. If there was a good idea, I'd say, okay, well, that should work, but it needs to be mixed in with this, and then you kind of like you create out of like that palette.
Yes.
Of different things. You steal good ideas and use them for your own purpose rather than merely copying them.
Yes.
And kind of like representing them.
Yes.
So I think it's quite, you can see that influence going on a lot sometimes. Mm. And I think it's the heart of wanting to be a games designer is that you start off by kind of saying, well, I could do a better job than that.
Mm.
And then you never stop.
Yes.
You can't stop tinkering. You always want to play. You always want to come up with more stuff.
And you keep having ideas and keep finding inspiration. The word I used in the original draft of the book that didn't make it through because it means nothing outside the UK was wombling, making good use of the things that you find.
Absolutely.
Which sadly didn't make it through the printed version. But I'll let foreign listeners Google that one for themselves. but looking at this list of the games that did win the Spiel, they are, whether they're memorable or not, and a number of them have just disappeared completely into obscurity, all of them, I think, have an influence on what comes later.
Hmm.
Just flipping down this, Heimlich & Co., Top Secret Spies, as it was known in English, Wolfgang Kramer's first win, hugely, hugely influential. It's one of the first hidden role games where you don't know what role the other players are playing. It's the first game with a Kramer Leister around a Kramer track, a score track around the outside of the board. One of the first games with meeple or anything like them. Not what we think of as meeple now, but those kind of flat wooden people. Game mechanics that feel German, because I do say this slightly too much and probably repeating myself. The first few Spiel winners are not German. I mean, they're literally not German. They were almost all published in different countries, but they don't feel like German games. So Heimlich & Co. is probably the first one can say feels like a German piece of German games design. It's got all the classic things. Everyone stays in. It's kind of cooperative. It's not cooperative, but you're not in direct competition with each other. You're not trying to knock each other out. You're not bludgeoning each other. You are trying to score more points than each other. And that was hugely influential. Café International, an early tile layer, inspires a bunch of things. Adolf Flichtet, Klaus Teuber's second winner, the game of antiques trading. Did you play that one at the time?
I think I did, actually. Sometimes it's interesting because of the influence. You kind yes. of like things cross over. But I, I was definitely, it's one of the ones that I'm aware of. Some of these games I'm not, really, I wasn't terribly aware of.
Yes.
But that was one. And it tends to be the games later in the list.
Mm.
I think that it's interesting what you're saying about, because some of the things that you're talking about there, I mean, the scoring track.
Yes.
It's almost an invisible thing, if you know what I mean. It's not, yes. The thought that it has to be invented.
Yes.
necessarily think about terribly much.
It dates back to cribbage boards and arguably even before that. But integrating it into the design of the game itself, I think was Kramer and Heimlich & Co.
But I think that, again, you can I think this period is interesting as well in that it's got quite a mix
of
really quite different sorts of games, but they also look quite different.
They do. There's no sort of uniformity of design or indeed presentation.
But you can see it being developed over the period, because you mentioned the Meeple there.
Yes.
And, so now when you think of German games, you think of really nice quality cardboard components, wooden pieces.
Yeah.
Right through to the box art on the front, yes. There's a particular style to it. You see the game. There are memes about it, but the classic one is somebody who's staring away from you, so you've got the back of their head, a vista of some kind or another that's a bit boring.
Yes.
But pretty, but boring.
Yes.
And
I want to say quite often with someone on a horse coming towards you in the distance. But yes, absolutely, a style. Actually, a lot of the ones slightly later, Doris Matthaus designed so many board game covers and components in particularly the late 90s. I'm sure we'll come on to her in a later episode.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, they all looked the same because they were literally by the same artist. Not quite as true of this period. Yeah. Manhattan is kind of interesting because Manhattan had computer-generated art on the cards. Okay. Very early, kind of blocky, primitive shading on it.
Yeah.
But there's no sense of coherence of style. But there is a sense of something coming together in terms of a design ethos and people learning from each other as to how these things can function.
Well, I think also, one of the interesting things about this period is this is the period that people were saying that traditional board gaming is dead.
Yes.
You know, that the computer games are here, they're becoming incredibly popular. And the number of, when working at Games Workshop, it still happens today, actually, but particularly in this period, people will say, aren't computer games going to do away with these sort of like tabletop war games and board games and things like that? Surely they've had their time. It's gone and passed. And you go, well, I don't think so, you know. We seem to be doing, Games Workshop was doing quite well. But also you knew from kind of like personal experience, one of the things I say is I'm quite sort of Catholic in my taste, and I like all sorts of games.
Mm.
I like role-playing games. I like classic games, bridge, backgammon. I like board games. I like tabletop war games. I like all of them, but I don't get the same experience from those things. They all push different buttons for me.
Mm.
They have different ways of kind of like I find different ways of enjoying things, and computer games are the same. They do certain things very well, but I think in this period, what the games manufacturers had to figure out was, well, we've got to emphasize the differences between the experience you have with a really nice board game and the experience you have when you play a computer game.
Yes.
Or, for that matter, a role-playing game.
Yes.
And also, like a collectible card game, basically, later on. I mean, that's not quite as true. But I think that it's a transitional period in terms of, establishing the importance of the quality of the components in general, like for board games, and the social aspects of it, that particularly with board games, it's a group of people coming together who like hanging out together, and this is an excuse
Yeah.
You know, you sit down, you're gonna laugh, maybe cry, depending on what your luck's like. And you might have a drink or two while you're playing. And you'll, at the same time, have an interesting little puzzle to solve in terms of the game that you're playing and you're learning about. And you'll be able to chat about it and decide whether you think it's a good game or not. So that's it's very social.
Yes, for me, the social aspect, I think, is absolutely key. And it is something that the German games have not exactly pushed necessarily, but it is always in the foreground that there should be enough space within the gameplay for people to just chat and make jokes. And I think laughter is hugely important. When I'm testing a game, one of my key rules is no matter how badly the rules are working, if people are laughing, then something within the game design is succeeding, is doing what it needs to do. And so it's worth pursuing. So I think, I mean, Catan for me is the one that gets it absolutely on the nail. The balance within that game is extraordinary. The cognitive load, the amount of space it takes up within your head to play. You are involved at all times. You are thinking about your move while it is other people's moves. You're also thinking about trading with them because every single person gets a trading phase within their turn. But at the same time, if you stop and chat for a little bit, and come back to it, you haven't forgotten your strategy. It's not so complicated that you will have forgotten what you were going to do next. And it's a very pleasing amount of space that it takes up within your head, or at least within my head. It's very satisfying to play. I mean, it's also satisfying to win. But just the experience of playing it is perfectly pitched.
Yeah. I think there's when you play a good game, it's difficult to describe. There's a neatness.
Yes.
About the way that the different bits fit together. And you just think, that's just nice. I like that. And Catan definitely does that. I think that the other thing is that the thing you were talking about there is that what's happened over this period is that before then, you could be knocked out of games.
Yes.
And a game was seen really as being a kind of like a very competitive kind of like thing. And Catan, you can think I don't stand a chance here, but actually you can still do stuff all of the way through. And I think that's something that over this period you start to see kind of like, you know, in hindsight, I doubt it was actually being thought about terribly much at the time, but in hindsight you can say, okay, I can see how what would be considered to be good games design methodology, you know, is starting to become established here.
Though none of us were talking about it in those terms back then. I mean, there wasn't really a vocabulary of game mechanics back then. If you'd said card drafting or something like that, or even roll and move, I'm not sure it would have been immediately apparent what one was meaning.
No. I mean, let's say the only one that I particularly remember right then is Hex Encounter for an American style board war game. And so at the time that this was going on, obviously, I was working away on board games for Games Workshop, and we were getting some of them were coming were coming from abroad. So Dungeon Quest was originally published by a Swedish company, and I used to be able to remember the name. I can remember that was a great game to play test because we got the Swedish cards. With little kind of like, you know, like kind of like translations of what the effect was, but the name was always the same. And there were some of them just had these hilarious names, which are, I'm sorry, lost to the mists of time now, sadly.
It is worth pointing out this is 30 years ago.
Yeah. It is a while ago. It is a while ago, and I'm famously absent-minded anyway. So, there was lots of stuff happening kind of like in parallel with this. And I think I think you're absolutely right. What I can't remember is sitting down thinking, okay, you know, what a game needs are these kind of elements and stuff. It was much more kind of like organic than that. You know, your game would turn up, you'd play it, and you say, well, this is rather cool.
Yes.
And that was it, really. It was, you'd kind of like, you'd go from there.
Yes, I remember when we were doing Once Upon a Time, myself, Richard Lambert, and Andrew Wilston, which was the same kind of time we started playtesting it. I can date it exactly. It was a New Year's party 1990, which puts a neat timestamp on the thing. We pitched it to Atlas Games in 1992, and pretty much the first thing John Nephew said was, this is really good, I really like it, but it needs more playtesting. But I think that was the extent of the editorial guidance we got. So it went through another month or a year of playtesting and finally came out and did well, I'm glad to say. But yes, there was a sense of what we were aspiring towards, but we lacked the vocabulary to talk about exactly how to do it. And I think when you know, the kind of the point balance and the playing to play rather than the playing to win thing, you look at modern Spiel des Jahres winners like Cascadia, and they seem to be balanced in such a way that everyone not just stays in the game, you can't get knocked out, but everyone feels like they are almost evenly balanced as you're going on.
Yeah.
And so quite often there are a number of games where almost always people are just within a handful of points of each other at the very end.
Yeah.
It's whoever's had that slight tactical advantage.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's, again, it's pleasing, it's satisfying, it has neatness to it.
Mm. I think, going off the slight tangent, I think we talk about games that aren't mentioned or didn't feature. For me, over the years, one of the best games designers I've ever worked with was a chap called Richard Halliwell. He designed Space Hulk. And Space Hulk, I think, is a beautiful bit of games design.
If we're talking about influential games, obviously Catan was massively influential, but Space Hulk, yes, wow.
And the thing that I loved about Hal was a truly eccentric character. He really was. But he never came at a problem head on. He was given the brief for Space Hulk. Brian Ansell, who ran the business at that time, said, I want a game with space marines in fighting some alien monsters. Because I think Aliens was around at that time. So
yes.
It seemed like a good fit.
Yes.
Now, how would be given a brief like that? And then if it was me, particularly sort of pre-third edition, blah, 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 as I was saying earlier on, I'd have probably come at it pretty much straight head on. I'd have said, well, I'll take the basic 40k mechanics and have some shooting and stuff like that. Advanced Hero Quest is a bit like that, actually.
Yes.
It's very... You can see its roots in D&D and the mechanics and stuff like that. Hal didn't. He'd come in sideways. And so he wouldn't hit the problem head. He'd come in... And so the timer... In Space Hulk, I think, is key, because what Hal had watched, he knew that the importance of alien and aliens as in the zeitgeist, basically.
Yes.
And they're tense.
They are.
They're really, really tense. They're horror movies. You know, they're scary. And what the timer does is it captures some of that viscerally within the game.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just such a clever little idea. And that's classic Hal kind of like thing, where you just kind of like think, well, I'll come in sideways.
Yeah.
He did a game, an underrated classic, I'd say, Blockmania.
That's back in print. Osprey's got
it
that.
It is. It's coming back out in print. And I think that's great, because it's such a clever idea. Because again, if it had been me, I'd have done it from above and like done that.
Yes.
You know, Hal was like, well, they're big tower blocks. You want to see them and you want to be able to knock them down. And that whole idea where you're basically playing, you've got a sideways view of a tower block divided into squares, but if you can make a hole all the way through, then it will fall down. Is again just a brilliant piece. He's a great games designer.
And
never got really.
He died quite recently.
Yeah, he did. He did. He'd been poorly for quite a while. Hal was talented, but with that talent went some troubles, basically. But I loved him dearly as a friend, and I do think that he designed the Warhammer game system. So you've given a bit of a brief, but basically that whole idea of roll to hit, to wound, and to save, which he'd been told he had to use D6s, but he knew that to cover the range of different creatures, he had to get enough kind of mechanical elbow room to differentiate things. And the way to do that was to split the D6 rolls up. And it can seem quite clunky now, but actually it does what it says on the tin. It works.
It works.
Basically.
It works.
And it's still... around, and people do variations on it to this day.
I think to say that Warhammer is around is a massive understatement, because well, you worked for it, but we haven't really touched on the success of Games Workshop, which at the start of the period we're talking about, 1986, was just moving up to Nottingham under the newish leadership of Brian Ansell at the time. Brian was bought out by Tom Kirby in a management buyout in 91 or 92,
yes,
I think.
Yeah, it'd be around about that.
And
yeah.
Then the company floated on the stock market in 94. 40 Warhammer was out at that point. Mm-hmm. 40K came out in
86, 87, like 87.
And was just, I mean, it floated on the stock market at 35 million, which at the time seemed like a huge amount for a hobby games company. And then, what, last year, I think, was valued at $6 billion. Was it $6 billion or £6 pounds? That is billion with a B.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that, yeah, I mean, Workshop continues to be successful. It's one of the, again, another great untold success story, basically.
It's extraordinary. I mean, certainly within wargaming, it's the Everest to everyone else's molehill. But even within hobby games, I'm not sure Hasbro, I've no idea what Hasbro's valuation is. And of course, it's a toy company as well. But they, last year, I think Dungeons & Dragons did $1 billion worth. So it's still huge. And based entirely on, you know, those core IPs of, well, not Warhammer anymore, but 40K and Age of Sigmar.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, the roots of the Games Workshop hobby, as it is now, are quite, they go back to Donald Featherstone, Charles Grant, and the kind of 1960s tabletop wargaming hobby.
Yes.
So certainly for people like me and Rick Priestley and Hal and Brian, we grew up playing historical war games things, but we also loved fantasy and science fiction and ended up kind of like merging the two things together to create Games Workshop.
But at the same time, it's not been this siloed development studio with no awareness of what's going on outside, because we were talking over lunch, we were talking about Shadespire, and Shadespire has modern game mechanics in it. There's some card drafting, there are things like that that have clearly come out of modern game design that in turn have been influenced by the School of German games design. So everything crosses over, as you were saying, everything borrows from everywhere else. And it's Warhammer's success is not entirely down to the genius of Warhammer. It's a collaborative effort, although if you were to show it to Wolfgang Kramer or Klaus Teuber, I'm not sure they'd necessarily agree. To wrap up, I mean, we've gone over some of the winners. Obviously, there were a bunch of other games at the time. Do you have a favourite non-Games Workshop, non-Spiel des Jahres winner from that particular period?
Well, I'm going to I will go with Kremlin. There are a few that I could choose, but Kremlin, I think, is a great game. It's an Avalon Hill game, originally from a German designer, I think. I think Avalon Hill might have got the license to do it.
I think it was Swiss originally.
Swiss is
my memory. I may well be wrong.
Yeah. It's a fantastic game where basically each player represents a faction within the Kremlin. You have various politicians in a kind of pyramid-like sort of like structure with the leader at the top has the most influences and different jobs underneath. But what nobody knows is how much control the other players have over each of the characters, and you reveal this over the course of the game. So at the start of the game, you allocate points to all of the different people. Now, what I think is particularly genius about Kremlin is that whenever any of the politicians do anything, they get stress. They get stressed by this. They build up stress. And in the end, they keel over dead from a heart attack, and they'll get replaced by that if they don't get hauled off by the KGB or something like that. So the people at the top tend to be older. So the way that stress is represented is that the age of the...
Yes.
So it's a little bit abstract. Their age increases until finally they die. You roll dice to see whether they manage to make it through to another turn. But what that means is that you can't just stick all of your points onto the people at the top of the pyramid, because while that might give you control over them early on in the game. Later on, the people from the lower ranks of the pyramid will get promoted up and start filling in the gaps. So you need to be ready at the end of the game to go, I had 8 points in this particular character all along, and now I'm going to wave for 3 times from the rostrum and win the game.
It's from the balcony of the Kremlin, isn't it, on the May Day parade. If you can wave 3 years in a row, you win.
Yeah.
But there is that glorious moment. I say glorious. It's always frustrating within the game, but looking back, it gives you a story to tell about the game, which I think is one of the great marks of a good game, that you can recount stories about how it went later. That, you know, you've spent turns maneuvering your person up through various minor offices to, you know, second in command or something like that. And then someone goes, actually, I have 9 points in them. They're mine. And, you know, it's not they're capriciously playing a card. They've had those 9 points since the beginning of the game. They just haven't declared them. It is, I think the interesting thing about it as well is it's a satire. It is a satirical board game that doesn't just have funny names. It does have funny names. But also it feels like it's a reasonably accurate representation of the way the Kremlin was working during the Cold War.
Yeah.
I agree. I think it's a brilliant game.
I think it's interesting. I played it relatively recently. I haven't played it for years, and we played a game. Still stands up.
Yeah.
It's definitely clunky in some ways compared to modern games.
This is the Avalon Hill version.
The Avalon Hill version, yeah.
I think there was a redo, but I...
They could well be, because it's a famous game. It's influential, basically. And I think particularly if you love your games you've had a chance to play it, you'll remember it.
Yes.
Because it's just got... you were saying earlier about Artist Steel.
Yes.
It's got a lot of very nickable ideas.
You could
reskin or repurpose or just borrow kind of like some of the concepts of it. There are certain games where I say... even sometimes some games where I don't really like them all that much, but I want them in my collection.
Mm.
You know, it earns its place in your collection because there's nothing quite like it really around. I mean, other games, they earn their place by being the first.
Yes.
So Dominion will always have a place in my collection because it was the first.
Yes.
Catan the same.
Yeah. Dominion we come to later on.
I know. I'm jumping ahead slightly.
But, yeah. Yes. I still have my copy of Kremlin as well. I don't think I've played it since the mid-90s, but it is... Again, I look over it from time to time. I go, this is clever. This is a really lovely piece, isn't it? For me, I think it's a game that the Spiel didn't consider. It's an American game, Tales of the Arabian Nights from Eric Goldberg, which is an early storytelling board game, because I do love my narrative games, in which one basically you take the part of a character within the Arabian Nights, wandering through the known world, or occasionally the unknown world, meaning kind of Europe and Africa and parts of Asia, having adventures. And the adventures, there's over in the basic game over 1,000 adventures. In the revised Z-Man edition, there are over 2,000 adventures that one can have. And they are madly random. They come from a combination of you draw a card, then you roll a die, and it could be anything. But there's massive lookup tables, and, you know, you'll meet a vengeful Ifrit, and you'll be given 6 options. You can parlay with it. You can trade with it. You can bribe it. You can attempt to seduce it. And again, all of these lead on to other you look this up in the book, find out what happened, and your wealth may increase and your status may decrease and you may be turned into a monkey. It's just gloriously random, but the stories it creates are joyous. There are no tactics, really. It's just... but it's always loads of laughter.
Yeah.
Really, really fun. And again, the influence it had on people going, we can actually tell proper stories with board games. Modern games like Above and Below and the series that came on from that, hugely influenced. I'm blanking on other ones.
We're talking about Tales of the Arabian Nights. I mean, that's influenced. There's a Games Workshop game, which is a kind of like one of the successors to Warhammer Quest, called Silver Tower. And that has a paragraph book. So you basically, it's a dungeon crawler with you lay tiles down and look things up, and it does exactly the same kind of like battery. It does it in a very small space. There are not 2,000 things in it. And I have to say here, this isn't a game that I worked on. I think it's a great little game. But you can see the influence of Tales of the Arabian Nights through to that. Mm. You know, so yeah, these mechanics are still around, and I think that like dungeon crawler games, I guess it's a whole genre in and of itself. I mean, like nowadays, more popular than it's ever been.
I think so. And you mentioned Advanced Hero Quest.
Hero
Quest, which was a Games Workshop MB co-production.
Yeah. About four that came out in this period, I think. 89, yeah.
89?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, right. So it's because, Hero Quest, I mean, is, like a very influential game in its way.
Yes.
Well, in its way, it's just a very influential game.
Yes, there had been pure dungeon bashes before that on a board, but HeroQuest was the one that kind of codified everything and the one that people copied.
Yeah, well, it went out to such a huge market as well, because the workshop was small then. It was a few million pounds turnover, I would guess, at the time that was happening, probably less than 10 million turnover a year. So it was getting through to a niche market, whereas HeroQuest was advertised on telly.
Yeah.
Broadsword. and so many people that I meet nowadays who like Games Workshop games said, well, I started out by playing Hero Quest or Space Crusade.
Yes.
One or the other of them. And that
so which led you first, Space Hulk or Space Crusade?
Space Hulk, I think, came out before Space Crusade, I think. Though they tend to kind of muddle up together in my memory. I think that Space Hulk was first. The thing with Space Crusade and HeroQuest was we designed the miniatures.
Yeah.
Games Workshop designed the miniatures, and Hasbro's in-house games design team designed the actual games. Uh-huh. And then Games Workshop, as part of the deal, got the right to do the advanced versions.
Mm.
So and that was me for my sin. So I did Advanced HeroQuest and Advanced Space Crusade. Right. Were both my designs, and you can see me learning. Mm. I'd say that both of them are overall particularly Space Crusade. My goodness gracious me! I learned a lot by not doing a terribly good job. I would say on that one. I've met people who say it's my favourite Games Workshop game ever. So you kind of like, go figure.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's fantastic, and it's fantastic. You know, games from the period do continue to live on, that, you know, they are just as playable today as they were. They may have some rough edges, but, you know, a good game mechanic is still a good game mechanic. It's fantastic. A very interesting and underrated period of history with some really interesting game development that really sees flower later on as people pick up and run with its ideas.
Well, I think it is setting the foundations, isn't it? And then giving something for people to build on.
Yes. Jervis, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for your time and your experience and the great games.
Yeah, that's been my pleasure.
My thanks to Jervis for giving up his time to speak to me. A couple of quick notes on things we talked about. Adelverflixtet, I apologise for my German accent, is a game of stealing or buying antiques and displaying collections. It came out in 1990 and won the Spiel des Jahres in the same year. It's a lovely game. It's, I think, been out of print for a while, but copies are not rare, particularly on German eBay. It does have English translations, rejoicing in the titles of Hoity Toity or Fair Means or Foul. There was an American edition that was inexplicably released under the title Adelverflixtet. Heimlich & Co. also has a number of English titles, Undercover, Top Secret Spies and several more. It too is out of print and well worth hunting down. Once again, copies are plentiful on German eBay. Do not be afraid of German eBay. For the second part of this episode, I talked to Mark Gascoigne, who's best known probably for his work with Games Workshop. He co-created the Black Library, their fiction arm, but was also instrumental in the early days of Games Workshop, editing titles for them, creating games and editing games. But he also edited the Fighting Fantasy line for Penguin Books, and he's currently running Aconyte, the book division of Asmodee, the world's largest games distributor. If you have a copy of Everybody Wins, it won't have escaped your attention that Aconyte is my publisher. They published the book. That is not why Mark is on the podcast. It's because he's an erudite and extremely well-informed authority on games, and also one of my oldest friends. So, Mark, you're the publishing director of Aconyte Books, which is part of Asmodee, the biggest games distribution company in the world these days. But that's not what you've always done. That's a comparatively recent thing. And in the time we're talking about, the essentially the mid-80s to the mid-90s and a bit before that, you came up out of games retail, in fact. So you were in games retail in London at the time that some people think of as kind of almost a golden age of board games.
Yes, hello. That's right, though. I'd never thought of it like that. For me, I came up out of being a gamer who then... And I specifically in the fantasy roleplay side, D&D got me into gaming, as it did several classmates at school. We formed a games club. We kept at it. We thought we knew better than everyone else. And, of course, roleplay games give you the opportunity to make your own variants on games. So we'd changed the rules. We'd invented our own scenarios, monsters, etc. So we thought, yeah, let's join the revolution and start a fanzine as well. Taking the tack, particularly, that we were going to take the mickey out of everything, and particularly, as it turned out, Games Workshop. So when I left university, I worked in a game store, Game Centre, who were the high street equivalent of Games Workshop back in those days. GW had a few stores, very hobby-based. Game Centre was more a mass-market toys and board games store, and I worked for them for a bunch of months, but they, alas, closed their business in early 84, whereupon I joined Games Workshop to be an editor. I was just 21, and I'd not written any games before. I'd not developed any games. But Ian Livingston, these days he says he gave me a job because it was the only way to stop me being a thorn in his side. That's what you do with these people. You make them legit. And I think that's both fair enough and him retelling the story a bit later. But I should also mention when he offered me the job, he did pretend to toss a coin to decide whether he was going to employ me or not. I joined them as a game developer and designer at a time when Games Workshop was really expanding from being an importer distributor of games in the UK into making their own. I went into the team that was led by Albi Fiori, one of the great names in that period of British games, game designer, author, crossword compiler, sadly no longer with us. He was knee-deep at the time in finishing up an edition of Railway Rivals, as mentioned in Everybody Wins, the legendary Games Workshop edition, sadly long lost.
Yes, the last English language edition of Railway Rivals, in fact.
Indeed, and also the first edition of a game that's still in print today after many editions, Talisman. And this was a second wave of board games after an initial try a year before I joined. And it would soon be followed by many more, including a bunch of games that I think you and Jervis discussed, which were imports from the USA, such as Kings and Things from West End and similar games, along with role-play games, as well as starting to develop their own, like the Judge Dredd game myself and Rick Priestley were working on, and the first formative editions of the Warhammer Skirmish game that eventually became a role-play game and the all-conquering beast of Warhammer. There were, obviously, we were bringing in Call of Cthulhu and Paranoia and Middle-earth roleplay and making those in brand new British editions, often, you know, upgrading the rules for local editions and really cementing the success of first roleplay and then fantasy board games in the UK.
So, Mark, the UK had been the world centre for board games. It was where everyone aspired to be, or gamers aspired to be. And then that was slowly moving over to America for the hobby game end of stuff, the more strategy games, the war games. And then there was this upcoming wave from Germany, which really started in the early 80s. But at the time we're talking, towards the late 80s and the early 90s, was growing steadily. I remember specialist board game shops, particularly Just Games in central yep. London, having German games imported. But from your point of view, being within a distributor, was there much of that going on? Was there much awareness, or was it just us?
I think it was definitely something you had to be into to know about. And I think the whole of fantasy gaming from late 70s when the explosion of D&D and all the follow-on games happened. That's what the first wave was about. It was these strange, exotic, imported little boxes or Ziploc bags or just individual rule books. They were very strange, exotic, overpriced things that you got on import. You went to Games Day with your pockets stuffed full of Christmas money or birthday money to just fill up on whatever. Certainly growing up at the tip of England, going to school in Ramsgate on the tip of Kent, we had a local game shop. And I think I bought about half of what they got into stock just because it was a game. It really was something that you would grab and try and learn more about because I was into it. I was a hobbyist from very early on. Some of those games never played. I'm Fantasy Games Unlimited's Gangster, I'm sure, was a wonderful system. Yeah, and I've laminated the rule books and rolled up characters, never played a session. One of these days. 40 years later, and similar.
Do you still have it?
Yes, indeed. No, I kept everything. But I haven't yet succumbed to eBay. I've told my son that he's going to have to do it all after I'm dead. But he mustn't just give it to a man for 20 quid. And the whole lot, I mean, if he does each of them at 20 quid, that will set him up fine. But from a hobbyist's and fan's point of view, it was things like the advertising in the early issues of White Dwarf and the occasional issue of Games and Puzzles magazine that were real gold dust. Yes, the articles were amazing and the reviews were, yeah, brought us into the details of the product, but just those lists of exotic names. For years, we puzzled over what this Empire of the Petal Throne game might be, or White Bear Red Moon, was it? The Chaosium game, and so on and so forth. Lords of the Middle Sea, and... But, you know, some of them we'd be able to track down, others not. My first proper hobby board game would have been an SPI war game that I would have bought sight unseen from a mail order advert, thinking that sounds interesting. And indeed, it was Star Force, their sci-fi proper war game of galactic conquest and empires. Notable these days only because one of the factions is called the Human League, and that's where they got the name from. Meanwhile, however, one of the group picked up a copy of SPI Sorcerer, which was a lot more to our taste. We were all fantasy fans. In fact, we'd gathered to play Tolkien wargaming using some own brand homebrew rules using the Hinchcliffe miniature range, and had got into D&D as much because we were fans of Tolkien and Michael Moorcock and Conan and Fritz Leiber books and so on. And Sorcerer was, although it was a hex war game, it was about individual wizards and controlling territory based on around a colour wheel, so red beat yellow beat green beat blue and so on. And that we played to death. And I think actually it's one of those things where if you only got two games, you alternate or you play one to death. By the time you've got 100 games, you're so stymied for choice you can't play anyway. But we very much enjoyed Sorcerer until we discover that one of our number was forever losing because he hadn't told us he was colourblind. That's a problem people are still trying to deal with now. But that was coming in from America. It was imported, and there were very few people covering them. These days, you'd find perhaps a dozen fan websites reviewing any game. And, of course, the venerable Board Game Geek aggregates an awful lot of reviews and opinions on games, along with the various YouTubers and bloggers and so on. But back then, there was no sense of an international community. There was plainly what felt like an old, established hobby on tabletop wargaming and hex and chit wargaming of the SPI, Avalon Hill and Strategy and Tactics end in the USA. But it all felt quite old. The new wave of role-playing games felt far fresher and new and more, I guess, street fanzine level. And very quickly, they started combining the stream. So as well as making RPGs, most of the early role-playing companies also dabbled in fantasy war games and then fantasy adventure games on the tabletop. We got an awful lot of play out of Divine Right, the early TSR fantasy game, because it had an awful lot of personality. There were individual characters. You could go off and attempt to appeal to barbarians on the edges of the map and roll a six, and on a six, they killed and ate you, of course. And on a one, they gave you twice as many soldiers and slaves as you needed to allow you to head back for the capital and hope to encircle it. The German and French scene was very, very quiet and in the UK. Now, part of that is a language issue. The Brits, the English particularly, they struggle to speak other people's languages. And even growing up only 22 miles away from France across the Channel, there wasn't much of awareness that simmering away in Europe just across the water, had we but known it, there was the beginnings of what would eventually turn into this great flood of wonderful games. And indeed, on the role play side, which is really my main area of influence, it was notable when Die Schwarze Augen, The Black Eye, the great German RPG, turned up. It was heralded as the German game. There weren't a lot of others on the listing in the awareness. We certainly weren't aware that Hare and Tortoise was going over and having multiple editions, and we certainly weren't aware that that there was a German edition of Railway Rivals, which I'd known from school, coming in tubes to be used educationally in the classroom. A great shock when it turned out we could also play it for fun. Things educational and things being fun often being two separate categories. But the idea that that was also making great waves as Dampfross in Germany, certainly I wasn't aware of that. It would be interesting to chart back as to when the first glimmerings of a European scene properly impinged. It probably wasn't actually until Catan, which is right at the end of the decade, which was, we did play, Jervis and myself and several other members of the game design team at Games Workshop, who I'd was about to rejoin, actually hadn't rejoined at that point, but we're all in Nottingham together as game fans, in the German edition with photocopied rules. And that's actually the thing that impinges on British fans and to some extent American fans of the time. The little slit in the back of the shrink wrap and the two or three photocopied pages of translated rules. And whoever was doing that, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because for people who were prepared to put the effort in the UK and beyond, they really were the only way you could access this sudden, amazing wave that was growing into a full-on tsunami of games from the UK. Unless you were a native German speaker. The kind of samizdat translation systems, I know some were run out of game stores, some were just hobbyists who just provided them. Again, only the internet only just starting by the end of the period, this sort of mid-90s time. But they really did open the door to suddenly access all these games for the first time, including Catan these days, obviously translated into many languages, and rightfully so. It should be played by everyone. But back in the day, that little set of rules, often the wrong size to fit in your box properly, which always annoyed me. Why they couldn't print them on square paper or whatever is a little finickety thing that reveals just what a nerd I am.
Yeah, I remember there was a thing called the Rules Bank or something similar, and you could send them a stamped addressed envelope with a request for a set of the English translation. And these were just typewritten and photocopied. They weren't laid out in any way. You didn't get the diagrams or even back then, the German rules had high production values. The English rules were literally, they were very much a fan production by people who did it because they loved it.
And we salute them for their tireless service, hobbyists way beyond merely just buying the games and playing them repeatedly.
You said that there wasn't so much of an awareness of the German thing. I was just thinking back to the magazines of the time, because in the 70s there had been Games and Puzzles. I don't know when Games and Puzzles stopped, but probably about the same time that White Dwarf was coming through, which was again focusing on the quirky niche area of games, though focusing much more on the American market rather than the European market. And then as White Dwarf was making the transition into being a magazine about Warhammer, Games International started up in the UK, as well as a thing I think called Games Review Monthly, which I'm less familiar with because I didn't write for it. I did write for Games International, but that was very much covering the European stuff. And Alan Moon used to write for it. They had interviews with people like Klaus Teuber and Wolfgang Kramer. And that lasted, I think, until it became Strategy Plus at some point. It had a name change and started doing computer games as well, because as so many companies have discovered, the UK is not a huge market for this stuff. And often really isn't large enough to support a company focusing on niche games.
Sometimes it's when the USA come on board, really, and the USA was a little slower, again, because producing so many of their own games, and I think a bit of language snobbery. The distance involved was simply too great. But slowly but surely, as companies like Mayfair started to take a chance on the new wave of games, and indeed that German importers into the USA of these games again with photocopied rules and then local editions. Suddenly, when you've got a bit of a movement, the media then grows to support it. Fans review things, they gather enough sales, they think about becoming semi-professional and then professional. The other thing we shouldn't forget, of course, is that, again, the grassroots level of support that had been running for a long time in the diplomacy hobby.
Yes.
Where a game that works better being played by mail or through a monthly or bi-monthly circulated fanzine or scrappy couple of pages put out on the bander in the school staff room when no one's noticing. Many dozens of these that our own fanzine allied with, and indeed for a while, Dragon Lords, my fanzine, run with a couple of wonderful schoolmates, ran diplomacy games, which on a bi-monthly turnaround raised some eyebrows in the diplomacy hobby. But those guys, again, they were there for the traditional board games, anything Avalon Hill, anything SPI, and anything in-depth that could be adapted to either play by mail or spending entire weekends in a hotel or with your friends around somebody's house, sleeping in sleeping bags, eating, playing, sleeping again. Those sort of in-depth games always had a grassroots support that, again, at its best would turn into little conventions, little away day conventions like Manicon, which as far as I'm aware is going into its 50th year now annually, and many others of these survive at a low level. They're also, I think, in the UK particularly, and I suspect in the US too, while there were plenty of fantasy gaming fanzines, there were board game fanzines as well. Tireless writers on games in the UK like Mike Siggins with his Sumo fanzine.
Oh, the great Sumo, yes.
Indeed. And hundreds of pages of reviews. An absolute, almost phone book of 300 games you'd never heard of every few months. Because he was monitoring the German scene particularly and pioneering that sort of stuff. And again, the moment you show someone like me who's keen on novelty and getting into things, the possibilities enshrined in all these amazing games, of course, some of them perhaps not quite as good as some of the reviews made out, or they were good for their time and were slowly subsumed. But I certainly have a great wing of my collection that are German and French editions that are only in German and just have their photocopied rule set even now, long after there's been proper English editions.
Yeah, I have the same thing because being a collector, I go over to Essen and spend most of my time and my money on the second-hand stalls where you can pick up absolute treasures for stuff that would cost you 50, 60 quid on eBay over here. You can have for 20 euros in beautiful condition. But of course, it's all in German and it's very easy to forget that.
Again, but these days, the modern equivalent of the rules bank, which is often just the rules PDFs on Board Game Geek, or indeed the local game, the game publisher's website themselves will often have downloadable rules, and across all sorts of different languages, including languages that they weren't marketing in the first place. And that, I think, that just helps get the name out and continues the popularity of it. One thing I am interested in is whether there is now a wave of nostalgic collection starting to build. In the role-playing space, and certainly early days of Warhammer and Magic the Gathering and so on, there is a massive collector's market for rarities, but also just because there's so much stuff that went beneath the radar at the time. As we've got older and society has become more geek-friendly, we've become a society that can look back and buy all the things we wanted when we were 15 or 25 or 45, because we're on salaries and we pay mortgages, but we use our hobby money to go back and buy nostalgic items. I noticed you and Jervis talking earlier about Ogre, which when I bought a copy, it was £2.45 in the little either Steve Jackson or Metagaming little plastic shell. These days, $100 will get you a 14-pound weight of box that will turn up with absolutely everything ever done for Ogre in it, and you couldn't have it. Whether it's any more likely to come to the tabletop depends on how many children you've got and what other hobbies you've got and what other uses there are for the dining room table. But it's we're now able to buy back as collectors, or indeed enthusiasts for back in the day, into these items. In the UK, certainly with podcasts like the Grognard Files, which talks about the early days of role play, the glory days of when Games Workshop was just bringing in RPGs and promoting them through the early days of White Dwarf, when TSR's Imagine magazine first started here, and indeed copies of Dragon and Different Worlds would start to drift in from the USA. There's a massive nostalgia for the old games, and indeed a massive collector's market to go back and buy up even the rattiest old Judges Guild supplements and Midkemia Press and Hahn and so on and so forth. But I'm not quite seeing it yet in board games. I'm wondering if that's partially because there's too many or because the gaming mechanics have moved on so much.
I think it's a combination of all of those things and a couple of others. There is this cult of the new in board games, particularly in board game media, that it's all about the new releases, the re-releases, what's on Kickstarter, what's going to be really exciting, what's bigger, what's better. Also, board games take up less time to play. They tend to be single session things, and this was true for a long time. Campaign games only really came through with the legacy stuff, or with really long war games like the legendary campaign for North Africa, which I still don't believe anyone actually ever played. I think people bought it to say that they'd got a copy of Campaign for North Africa.
I bet if we look up, someone will have played it, but only in the last few years, to break the record, to say, yes, it has been done,
and
yes, it's been a long
time. Yes, it does take
a world of YouTube and blogging and community forums does that.
Yes.
And, yeah, legendary games like Civilization, and you play the full game with all the expansion sets and so on and so forth. Or, indeed, even playing Talisman with the dragon and the dungeon and Timescape across all floors in your house.
Yes.
Which I certainly know people. Nick, who works in Aconite, tried that once, and I believe it took them 4 weeks, by which time their mum had to get them to pack it up because they kept getting gravy in the dice cup.
Good Lord, people talk about Monopoly lasting a long time. But the thing is, in most of these games, most of the shorter games, people don't get quite as invested in them. They don't make quite as much of a mark in your life, whereas role-playing games you can live with for years, literally decades even. They become a very important part of not only who you are, but who you used to be, and your nostalgia for that past, and wanting to reclaim that, particularly if you now have the money to do it. You were mentioning fanzines. When we were doing Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, there was an excellent fanzine called Warhammer, called Warpstone. We basically helped them out with printing and distribution. Early copies of Warpstone now go for a decent three-figure sum. And this is something that was only released in the late 90s. It's only 25 years old. It was, and there were reasonable numbers of copies. We're not talking about a milestone thing like an early edition of Dungeons and Dragons. They were produced as ephemera, which is probably why there aren't actually that many of them left.
Yeah. How many people, of course, would be paying 100 plus bucks for a copy of Warpstone or indeed Dragon Lords or My Fanzine or whatever is a moot point.
Yeah.
But to be honest, if there's 20 of them, that says there's a collector's market.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know how much of this is getting written up as well.
Mm.
The UK this year, just in general kind of pop culture, has seen three different comprehensive guide to fanzines. I haven't read any of them. They're all at least two of them are only just coming onto the market in the next couple of weeks. But these are published by proper pop culture publishers in the art book or sort of cultural studies area. I don't know whether they even touch on sci-fi and gaming magazines. Certainly the covers are all copies of Ripped and Torn and Sniffing Glue and the football fanzines and so on, which is perhaps seen as a little less nerdy. But sooner or later, there has to be the equivalent of, is it Bradstreet's Guide for comic books? There has to be something that says, oh, yes, this limited edition of Underworld Oracle, number 5, only barely torn, the fine grading, that sort of stuff. Features part 2 of The Alchemist, special character class for D&D, third edition kind of stuff. 150 quid. There must sooner or later be this. Obviously, I got quite involved with Fighting Fantasy on the game books and the spin-off RPGs. And there is a chap, the Fighting Fantasy Collector, who monitors all of these because he's the trader in all of this. And he has all the different variant editions and the giveaway bookmarks and the special dice and all those things all carefully priced up. And I think slowly but surely we are heading into a zone where the nostalgia will be a part of it as well.
Yes.
I think it's interesting with role-playing games, again, as you mentioned, I think the passion involved in those means that you can reissue your first edition rulebook. as a collector's item for the, and you know you're never really going to play it, though I know there are some people who play white box or basic set, you know, white, red and blue set D&D, because they like the simplicity of it. But for the most part, it's just about having it and having the complete range of them. Board games, I don't know whether they go to that same place, whether one wants to head back and get a very first edition of a game that has developed over time into something better. It's rare that a board game 20 years later is different. It's better. Whereas, you know, while the D&D rules, you know, will have improved or changed, some may for the good or for ill, they'll get more complex or more simple according to the strategies in the current wave of the game. But actually, it's also about the worlds and the characters embedded in them. And I think that, again, might be the difference between the board game passions and role-play passions.
Yes, I think you're right. I'm thinking of back, there is a collector's market for some board games, particularly rarities, rare variants. I've never seen a copy on sale, but I'm aware people are after it. Multiple people are after it, including me. Tower Blocks, which was an unpublished Games Workshop game. They did 120 sample copies for the Toy Fair at Earl's Court in, I think, 1982 or 1983. Never actually went, didn't get a great response from the buyers. They sold all rights to it to the people who made Kensington, who didn't do anything with it. The interesting thing about Tower Blocks is it's Jenga. It's Jenga about 9 months before Jenga came out.
Plastic pieces?
Wooden, I believe. I've seen one. Ian Livingston still has a copy. And the photo for the entry on Board Game Geek is my photograph of his copy. But, you know, so that, yes, rare collectible, but also that's got the Games Workshop connection in there. Early Games Workshop stuff is valuable to collect.
Warhammer for Workshop obviously has become all encompassing, and it does encompass board games and role playing games and computer games and all things beyond that. But I'd be fascinated to know how many collectors of everything early Games Workshop. Steve Jackson and Ian Livingston have recently published their memoir of the very early days of Games Workshop in a book called Dice Men. It's just hitting the stores.
We haven't recorded it yet, but I think Ian will be plugging that very heavily, or in chronologically as people listen to this, we'll have plugged that very heavily in the previous episode.
And what a great job he did of that. But, you know, I think that was the equivalent of a Kickstarter in the publishing world, which is Unbound over here in the UK. And I think the one of the pledge levels, you got a photocopy of issue 5 of Owl and Weasel, which was the first mention of Dungeons and Dragons in the UK. I'd be fascinated to know just how many people are collecting all that ephemera from back in the day. Certainly when they pop up on, you know, a Twitter feed devoted to the early days of Games Workshop or Daily Dwarf, the regular look at very early issues of White Dwarf on the gaming side, it always attracts attention. But why am I interested? Actually, you know what? I'm interested because I've got a whole back bedroom full of this stuff, because I was there when GW was being shut down and things were going in skips, except they weren't. They were coming out of the skip again, and if I thought it interesting, so whether it's catalogues or indeed early copies of Owl and Weasel, the first one as a single folded sheet of A4 was just being thrown in the bin. So I was told I could have it, and various copies obviously found their way into charity auctions and so on, and various collections over the years.
You gave one to me. I gave it to a charity auction in Ireland, having got it signed by Ian and Steve.
There we go. It would have been lost otherwise. But
yes, this stuff, I mean, it was conceived as ephemera. But to take a step back from that, I mean, we talk about collectability, and as people who have been in this hobby for most of our lives, it's lovely to think that our collections are increasing in value. But on another level, I love the fact that you can still go into collector's shops and pick up treasures from the 1970s, treasure, or even the 1960s, for affordable amounts of money, for the equivalent of a new game, or even less. At Essen, I picked up a 1964 edition of Sid Sackson's Acquire, which I would say ought to be £1,000 game for its influence, for its quality, for the quality of its play, for the production values on it. It should be £1,000. It cost me, as I recall, €15. And I don't imagine there are many kids who are
reading this stuff. Maybe they will read my book. I can live in hope. Mm-hmm. Go, that sounds interesting. This chap Wallace sounds really enthusiastic about it. Maybe I'll see if I can find a copy. Maybe they find one and they will pick it up and they will play it. And it is accessible to them in a way that the early issues of White Dwarf or early editions of Warhammer are not, because the collectors have commanded that end of the market.
Yeah, as I've grown as a collector of games, I find myself buying further and further back, and actually less and less discriminately. You know, if there's a £10 perfectly nice copy of Spyring, as I found the other week, in that wonderful very 60s Get Smart second edition, I think, I'll have that. But I'm not looking for the first edition. I'm looking to play it and really just to possess it. I'm not quite at that level. Or any old, one of the most British, most venerable British card game manufacturers, Pepys, who made all sorts of games from just before the Second World War, including games about the Blackout and spies and murder trials and collaborators and all sorts of things. Again, they are out there in junk shops and charity shops and occasionally in antique shops for, you know, £5-10, sometimes very played, but often, you know, sitting in someone's back of someone's cupboard and in very high quality. I'd be interested to know, with Everybody Wins, looking at, you know, the fact that we start in 79 with Hare and Tortoise and so on and so forth, there are games which you can buy a brand new edition of. And I think people reading about the gameplay and the wonders of some of these games, because some of these are complete revelation, never heard of some of these games. And some of them I knew. In other words, I've got a copy of Heimlich & Co., but under the Ravensburger UK edition of Undercover, for example, which if I'd remembered, we could have photographed that one rather than schlepping stuff to and from Nottingham to London and back again in order to take the pictures for the book. But for many of these games, I'm certainly intrigued to play them, and I haven't played all of them.
Some of them, I have to say, you know.
Of course, of course. You play it once, and then you think, well, had I played that when I was 15 with my mates, that would have been like any number of games, frankly, from back in the day that weren't that brilliant. Mm. Yeah, most of Waddington's output in the 70s was interesting and passed a long summer holiday, but it wouldn't, you wouldn't hold it up as an absolute classic. They're 5 and 6 out of 10. But in its time, it would have been interesting. And I think as someone interested in the development games, I would love to play these. I would be interested to know if people will use this as a shopping list to go back and pick up some older games. By the time late 90s hit, we're starting to get into games that are in print and will remain in print forever. And by the time you get to, you know, the turn of the millennium, Carcassonne and so on, they're always going to be there in whichever edition and online and who knows, perhaps Carcassonne the movie or whatever at some point. They are absolute classics. Other ones, you know, they are sidelines, and people who read the book will decide which of those they are, whether it's, you know, traditional board games or your more 3D constructions or the younger games or the slightly strange card games that seem to kick in towards the end. But all of these, I think I'm interested to know what people are going to do with the information in Everybody Wins, because it's not just about, hey, look at these crazy old games. This is about how tastes change and about how people progressed in their thinking about what makes a good game. This is how we got here. And that absolutely fascinates me.
Yeah. Just to take one step back a moment, mentioning games that are out of print and that ought to be collectible. And I think in the UK, certainly the English edition is, El Grande, Wolfgang Kramer's, I would argue, masterpiece. Amazing game of area control. Just gorgeous. So much fun to play. Difficult to play in the German edition because there's a lot of cards with a lot of text on them. But been unavailable in English for decades, and I don't know why that is. I suspect there may be some trouble with the rights somewhere, because it's a collaboration with, I think, I want to say Richard Urich, but I could well be wrong on that.
And obviously tricky to get all the parties around the table to get a new edition agreed.
Yes. But yes, so some of these are rare, some of them, and really should be widely recognized. And El Grande has a lot of the qualities that you said you played Railway Rivals in school, which is interesting. And it was created by a geography teacher to teach geography and elements of history and the spread of the railways. I acquired it at my first games fair, the first UK residential convention. I was, I think it was 14 or I can't have been 14. I think I was 15.
So that's mid-80s again?
Early 80s. People would be able to date me from that. 82 or 83, I think. And it's, you know, for it became for us, for my group at school, when we weren't role-playing, what Sorcerer was for you. We just played it and played it and played it and thought about it and thought about tactics. And just to this lovely, lovely game, unavailable in English since the mid-80s. And you can pick up Damp Frost, but it's not the same because it doesn't have the England map in it.
Well, that's the other question I think Everybody Wins as a book does throw out. Just to hark it back to the trigger for all this rambling conversation of two old men, it sort of throws down the gauntlet.
Yeah.
Yeah. If not to you, but if Railway Rivals is a classic, and it is, who's going to get the next edition out?
Yeah.
How are we going to sort this out? And who's going to cut through this?
Well, I spoke to the guy who owns the rights. He's actually a very old friend. I won't name him. Save him his blushes. Last time I spoke to him about it, he thought it was a game that had had its time. Its time had passed. And yes, some of the mechanics are a bit old-fashioned. There's an awful lot of dice rolling in it. But it still works as a game. I've played it with my family. I've played it with games design students in universities. And inevitably, there's someone at the end who goes, where can I get a copy of this? And the answer is, you can't. Not unless you're prepared to pay silly money on eBay.
Or you get some hex sheets and a photocopier and your own Chinagraph pencils or whatever.
That's the other thing. Do it yourself and maybe do it better because, you know, that's where a lot of game design comes from.
Well, I think that may be what one of the reasons why there aren't tens of thousands of people clamoring for it. There are train games is a whole subsector. And but I was going to say it's interesting that Railway Rivals has withered, whereas the 18 series... Mm. Is that Francis Tresham?
That's
is
Francis
that right?
Tresham.
That's still going on, and we have mutual friends who have recently contributed games to that line a good 40 years after the first glimmering started up, the first boilers were stoked, and it started to chuff. It's plainly something that fulfills a need and scratches an itch, but can be built on and improved and obviously modified for different historical periods and so on. It seems like every game publisher, certainly with a nice wide range, should have its own game range. I've noticed our lovely friends at Osprey in the UK have just announced Village, or just started producing Village Rails, which look great in a kind of mini rails, fairly self-contained thing. But even down to tiny card games, Island of Trains, through to the epic, you know, multi-board stuff, and of course, absolutely at the pinnacle, Ticket to Ride, winning families over to a whole new way of playing with trains, new way of playing for the last 20 years or 18 years, and but you know, it's obviously it's never gone out of fashion to lay out routes and attempt to follow them and beat people to the destination or to hit enough stations in time for tea or whatever the winning conditions are. So it's a great shame about Railway Rivals. Perhaps it was just drawing routes on a map and then rolling dice was just a bit too traditional a mechanic for it to survive. I would say cleaning the boards, with particularly if you had accidentally used the wrong sort of pen because you'd grab something because you'd lost them, was always going to be a bit of a challenge.
The worst thing is just opening up the box and realizing you forgot to clean the boards the last time you put it away.
It's still engraved into it.
That takes some serious scrubbing. But no, lovely, lovely game. Mark, this has been absolutely fantastic. Always a delight to sit and chat with you.
Well, thank you very much.
Any opportunity, there'll be many more in the future, I hope. But for the purposes of Everybody Wins and the podcast, I should say Mark is the publisher at Aconite. Aconite is the company that has published Everybody Wins, so I owe Mark.
That's why he kept harking back to the name of the book, you see. It's all marketing, isn't it, dear?
It is. Mark, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Mark's and Jervis's influence runs through British games design and, by extension, American and German games design. You can get a sense of their fingerprints on things from the mid-1980s onwards, both very influential, if perhaps not quite as lauded as some of their peers. It was delightful to talk to them and to finally get a chance to just really reminisce about the old days. That's it for episode 2. Thank you so much for listening. I hope it's enhanced your understanding and your enjoyment of my book, Everybody Wins, The Greatest Board Games Ever Made, published by Mark by Aconite Books. In episode 3, we'll be switching our focus not to Germany at this point, but over to America, where we're talking to two people who were instrumental in bringing about some fairly major change in the time we'll be looking at, mid-1990s up to mid-2000s. We'll be talking to Peter Atkinson, best known as the man who published Magic the Gathering, and the cartoonist and game designer John Kovalik, the creator of the very long-running comic strip Dork Tower, illustrator of Munchkin, and, what's perhaps less known, co-creator and illustrator of a game that created a minor revolution of its own in the late 1990s, Apples to Apples.
I hope you'll join me then.
This is the Play to Win podcast from Aconite Books, with me, James Wallace. This first series of the podcast accompanies my new book, Everybody Wins, 4 Decades of the Greatest Board Games Ever Made, out now in the UK and coming to the US and Canada in spring 2023.